Chadwick, and Wilson Town Council. James D. Ruby, Sir Benjamin D. Reed, Appalachian Council.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Matt Fitzgerald on behalf of James Dunlap, and I'll plan to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
We're here on two certified questions from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. The first is whether tortious interference with contract and business expectancy are predicate unlawful acts under Virginia's business conspiracy statute. The answer is yes. The second is what the statute of limitations is for the tortious interference claims in this case. And the answer is 5 years under Code Section 8.01-243B. Now, because these are certified questions, and because the first one in particular is a very pure legal issue, I will get straight to the legal arguments and address the facts only as they become relevant. So the first question is whether tortious interference with contract and business expectancy are predicate unlawful acts for the conspiracy statute. And this is essentially the Station 2 question. The key difference between this case and Station 2 is that Station 2 was fundamentally a contract case, whereas this case is fundamentally a tort case. That is, if the conspiracy statute didn't exist, Station 2 would have been a breach of contract case, period. This case would have been a tort case for tortious interference with contract and business expectancy. And so, to get into Station 2 briefly, so in Station 2, the plaintiff was a restaurant. It had contracts with the landlord and the developer to allow it to install soundproofing material in the roof of the restaurant. The landlord and developer got together and breached their contracts, preventing the soundproofing from being installed. The restaurant then went out of business and brought suit against the landlord and developer. Brought a series of claims, but three that are relevant here: breach of contract, fraudulent inducement to contract, and the conspiracy statute. Now, as the court noted in Station 2, in footnote 8 specifically, well, first the court held and then noted, the fraudulent inducement claim was not adequately pleaded. And so for that reason, the tort claim in that case could not serve as the unlawful act predicate for the conspiracy statute. So when it came time to determine whether there was a predicate adequately pleaded, the only remaining predicate before the court was breach of contract. And so the court held that a, quote, mere breach of contract was not a sufficient unlawful act. And the rationale stated by the court was very clear, that if you allow mere breach of contract to be the predicate for the conspiracy statute, then you're blurring the line between contract and tort. You're essentially giving in to the pressure that tort has to take over contract cases, and you're allowing contract to drown in a sea of tort. So to avoid that, the court held that a, quote, mere breach of contract claim is not a sufficient unlawful act predicate. Now, in Station 2, the court specifically distinguished cases where a tort was adequately pleaded. So, for instance, addressing its previous case, Advanced Marine, the court said, quote, in Advanced Marine, the plaintiff alleged that a defendant knew its actions would constitute actionable tortious interference, knowingly weighed the cost of damages, and purposefully proceeded with its plan. So, what we have here is fits under that distinction made in Station 2. So, because here we have adequately pleaded tortious interference with contract and business expectancy claims against parties who are not, there's no breach of contract claim brought in this case. Leff and Cotman are not parties to the contract between Dunlap and AMCO. So, under Station 2 then, the holding, which is that mere breach of contract is not enough, does not apply here. The rationale that we need to protect contract from encroachment by tort doesn't apply here because we already have a tort case here. And this case falls within the cases distinguished in Station 2.
Okay, so, let me stop you right there. Let's assume that we agree with you up to this point. To have the business conspiracy claim, we've talked about that, and we require, because of the requirement of malice in the statute, what we've called an unlawful act.
Yes.
Okay. So here, your position is that the tortious interference claim can constitute, as a matter of, from a legal standpoint, that unlawful act.
Yes.
Is it your position that any tort would? I know that's not the question in front of us, but sometimes we ask hypotheticals so we can explore the boundaries of where we're going.
Yes, Your Honor.
Should it be an intentional tort?
Probably an intentional tort. Well, so this is what I'm thinking. It goes in the element of legal malice, and the legal malice means an intentional unlawful act. So if you're going to place it in next to intentional, effectively, this is an intentional tort, and yes, an intentional tort would certainly qualify.
Okay, within the tortious interference claims, we've recognized a distinction when there is a contract at will versus one that's not at will. And when it's not an at-will contract, then we don't require improper methods. But if it's at-will, we do require improper methods, and we've listed some of those in various cases. So is it your position that that would not make a difference, that as long as it's an intentional interference claim, it wouldn't matter whether you showed improper methods or not, or alleged improper methods?
Right. I think that's correct, Your Honor. Well, because...
I'm trying to figure out what is an unlawful act. If we agree with you that Station 2 doesn't apply, doesn't answer this case,
right,
then I'm trying to explore exactly how a tortious interference claim is an unlawful act and what about it makes it an unlawful act for purposes of business conspiracy claim.
Well, it's an unlawful act because it's a recognized tort, essentially. So what you have in a tortious interference case is you've got your duty breach causation damages, and the duty is the tort duty, the free-floating tort duty, not to intentionally injure other people's contracts. So then you have the breach by Leff and Cotman encouraging, pushing AMCO to breach its contracts. Then you have the injury to Dunlap caused by that. So because there's an adequately pleaded tort of tortious interference, that fits into the business conspiracy statute because it is the unlawful act. It's an intentional unlawful act. That takes care of legal malice. Of course, you still have to show the other elements of the business conspiracy statute, which would be the concerted action and then also the injury to business.
Would fraud in the inducement be sufficient to be a predicate act?
The court in Station 2 seemed to suggest that that would be true in footnote 8. Yes.
But it really didn't decide it.
No, it said, it's exactly, Your Honor. It said fraudulent inducement is not adequately pleaded here, right, and for that reason couldn't qualify.
But if it were adequately pleaded, is it your position that it would qualify separately from, for example, what you have here today?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it would. So,
does it depend on what relief would be requested? You have a fraud in the inducement claim. The relief requested sometimes is rescission, which is a contract remedy. And Station 1, if it stands for anything, stands for the proposition we don't want to turn ordinary contract actions into torts. So if fraud in the inducement had as a requested remedy rescission, would that be sufficient?
I think...
By the way, I please don't get off track, but what Chief Justice Kinzer and I are both doing is trying to figure out the boundaries. Mm-hmm. I think you make a great argument that tortious conspiracy may very well stand all by itself. But I want to know how far it goes.
Well, I believe if a fraudulent inducement claim is adequately pleaded, then it falls in the tort area. And so even if in some cases rescission might be sought, which is ordinarily a contract remedy, that because it already falls on the tort side of the line. So, I mean, in other words, what happened? Station 2 is a good example of this. They didn't plead fraudulent, they failed to plead fraudulent inducement in Station 2 because they failed to plead that the parties knew they were going to breach the contracts when they entered into them. So, had they adequately pleaded that, the court would have recognized that that was an adequately pleaded tort. And the tort, I submit, is what plugs into the business conspiracy statute and allows that to be an unlawful act independent.
Yeah, but that was why I asked you a minute ago whether it seems to me like what you're saying, that as long as you've pled some tort, that that can be an unlawful act for purposes of the business conspiracy claim. Is that what you're saying? Any tort? As long as it's a freestanding tort.
As long as it's a freestanding tort. And I note, though, that legal malice requires an intentional unlawful act. So it may not get you that far if you've got negligence or something. You're not going to be able to progress well under the business conspiracy statute.
And fraud in the inducement is, in fact, an intentional tort.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And even though the rescission remedy sounds as if it were a contract remedy. In fact, what you are arguing is, were it not for the fraud, I never would have entered into the contract.
Right.
And therefore, at least part of the remedy I seek is for the contract to go away.
Right. Okay. Yes.
I guess the best response you could have to all of this would be, you don't have to decide all those questions today, right?
That's right, Your Honor. So, to turn to the statute of limitations question, the question here, the statute of limitations question, boils down to whether the injury in this case is, quote, injury to property. And if so, under 243B, then the statute of limitations is 5 years. This case is controlled by Worry versus Bose. This issue is controlled by Worry versus Bose, 1956. Now, at that time, the statute of limitations was different. It was Code Section 8-24. And it required, the difference was survivability. So if an action was survivable, then it was 5 years. Otherwise, it was one. But the key to survivability was the same issue we have here, which is injury to property was considered survivable. So in Worry, what the court did was it specifically held, in Worry, the court found injury to business was injury to property. And the specific injury in Worry was the loss of rights under a non-compete agreement, the loss of customers, a according loss of profits, and then also a diminishment in the value of the business. Those are exactly the same injuries that we have here in this case. And so, for that reason, the holding of the court in Worry, which was that, quote, the right to performance of a contract and the right to reap profits therefrom are property rights, applies the same in this case.
Now, I don't want to tie you in knots, but the dilemma is that suppose it happened to be a fraud case.
Mm-hmm.
Would we adopt, as a predicate act to conspiracy, would we adopt the statute of limitations for fraud and apply it to the conspiracy as well?
No, Your Honor. I think that the conspiracy statute has its own statute of limitations, which is 5 years. Under 243B, it's not in the statute.
So, you probably don't have to answer this question to prevail on your point, but if you filed the case in the third year and you were clearly beyond the statute of limitations for fraud,
yes.
Is it your position that you simply prove it? You don't have to prevail on it. It is a predicate act, whether it is an actionable cause of action.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, let me go back to the question we have here. This, it asks if it's the question to us is it 2 years or 5 years for the tortious interference with contract and tortious interference with the business expectancy.
Yes.
We've recognized there's a difference between a contract and a business expectancy, obviously.
Yes.
Worry talks about contracts, uh-huh, and that your right to performance of a contract is a property right. And the case a few years ago, Willard versus Moneta Building, it was stock rights there, but we sort of took that same idea, that's property and you're interfering with it. So is it the same for the business expectancy? I mean, is that a property right?
Yes, it's the same for the business expectancy.
Okay, tell me why. I mean, with contract, worry. But this is expected since not a contract.
That's true. I would note, though, that in this case, the business expectancy claim is essentially a backstop.
Well, we're not deciding your case is over in the federal court. We're answering a question of law. What is the statute of limitations for tortious interference with contract and tortious interference with business expectancy? I'm asking you, are they the same?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because you can't completely get away from the facts of any given case when you're applying the statute of limitations. And the injury to property, there can be an injury to property coming from a tortious interference with business expectancy. In other words, Dunlap here, for instance, expected that he would continue to be able to advertise. He expected a flow of...
Yeah, but we don't have statute of limitations on causes of actions that are different. I mean, it's either 2 years or it's 5 years for tortious interference with a business expectancy. When we're answering questions of law certified by the federal courts, we don't get into the facts of a particular case don't drive the decision. We're answering a question of law.
Well, I think when it's a statute of limitations question, it's impossible to completely get away from the facts of the case because that's how the statutes are structured. You know, so it's like if they were asking what's the statute for this negligence action, the court would be looking at the facts of the case somewhat in order to determine, well, this one's injury to person, this one's to property. So the injury here, the injury under the tortious interference with contract and the injury under tortious interference with business expectancy are the same injury. They are harm that diminished the value of Dunlap's business. And I'm not sure if I have any more time, but
no, you don't. You've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is James Rubinger. I am here on behalf of the Appalese Cotton Transmission Systems, Inc. and Todd Leff. We are here on two certified questions. I'd like to address first the business conspiracy statute issue. And in particular, it's our position that station number two does govern this case. respectfully, Mr. Fitzgerald did not really even address the holding of station number two. The holding of station number two is that in order to be an unlawful act, there must be a breach of a duty independent of a contract. It did not simply hold that breach of contract may not be an unlawful act, nor did it hold that any tort may be an unlawful act. It said there must be a breach of a duty independent of a contract. A claim for tortious interference with a contract is certainly not independent of a contract. Indeed, one of the elements of tortious interference with a contract is breach of contract. So it's hard to see how you can characterize tortious interference with contract as being a breach of an independent duty. Now,
well,
yes, there is an independent duty not to interfere with the contract.
And that's the common law duty that underpins the tort claim.
Correct. But it is not independent of the contract. It's different, but it is not independent of the existence of a contract. If there's no contract, there's no claim for tortious interference.
You know, in order for you to make that argument, a business expectancy and a contract have to be identical.
In this case, they are. I recognize that in not every case they are.
Well, the only reason, I don't mean to surprise you, I just mean to, when you get to the statute of limitations question, the Chief Justice has divided the two.
Right.
For the purpose of the statute of limitations. If you start your argument on one half of the case by saying they're the same, it's going to have to slide through to the second half of the case too, isn't it?
Oh, from my argument, they are the same. Neither one is an injury to property.
All right.
So I'm clean on that one. And as Chief Justice pointed out, the tort of tortious interference does not require, in most circumstances, an unlawful act. So a holding that tortious interference constitutes, in and of itself, constitutes an unlawful act for purposes of the business conspiracy statute, is to essentially criminalize tortious interference.
Well, that's why I asked your opponent whether, if we answered the question yes, should we say but only for tortious interference claims where there's an improper method that's alleged?
I think the answer to that is yes.
It's a different category.
Yes. We certainly don't claim that the fact that tortious interference might be pleaded under a certain set of facts insulates the conduct from being an unlawful act under the business conspiracy statute. You can think of lots of examples where there would be an unlawful act. It would still be tortious interference. For example, if it was alleged that my clients burned down Mr. Dunlap's building, that would be tortious interference. There would also be an unlawful act. And I think that would be actionable under the business conspiracy statute. But when all
because
there is...
Because there was a criminal act that was a part of it.
A criminal or some other tortious
arson, whether...
Yeah.
In terms of your argument that tortious interference with contract presumes the centrality of the contract, what about tortious interference with business expectancy, then, where there is no contract yet? What is your argument in response to that?
My argument in response to that is I recognize that this court's dealing with a broader legal issue. I'm dealing with this case.
We've got a certified question that says tortious interference with contract or tortious interference with business expectancy. That is this case.
Right. The Fourth Circuit also indicated that it hoped this court would explain under what circumstances. And I think in the circumstance where the business expectancy arises out of the contract, the claim in this case, I think the other side concedes this, the claim in this case is that the tortious interference with the business expectancy is not independent of the contract. It depends very much on the contract. There's no business expectancy other than that which exists in the contract in this case.
You are making the argument that if there is tortious interference with contract based upon the statute and based upon our jurisprudence, that you could not then have a statutory conspiracy claim. But necessarily, if that is your argument, then tortious interference with business expectancy would be the predicate act for a conspiracy claim.
If the claim is independent of, alleges a breach of a duty independent of a contract.
Okay. Now, when we look at what the legislature meant, your argument ultimately comes down to saying that the legislature intended for there to be greater legal sanctions available if you have tortious interference with a business expectancy, with the inchoate possibility that there may have been a contract. That the legislature intended greater sanctions in that instance than the legislature intended if you, in fact, have tortious interference with the contract itself. So that it's hard to conceptualize with the General Assembly intending that business expectancy would have a higher dignity than contract.
I expect that the General Assembly did not intend for either one to form a predicate act for the business conspiracy statute, simply because, as you say, the sort of amorphous nature of the business expectancy issue. But given the facts of this case and the holding of station number two, I think that certainly any business expectancy that arises out of a contract does not give rise, tortious interference with such a business expectancy does not give rise to an unlawful act. Whether one that does not arise out of the contract is not this case.
Well, but it is this certified question, and you are here to argue for an answer of no to this certified question. So what would our rationale be? If our rationale for saying tortious interference with contract is not the predicate act because the contract is central to the transaction, then what would our rationale be for also answering no for tortious interference with business expectancy? We can't duck that one.
In the circumstance in which the business expectancy does not arise out of the contract, I'm not aware that there is precedent to suggest that your common sense formulation is not right.
But all business expectancies anticipate a contract at some point.
I think that's right.
So you,
I'm trying to conceptualize a business expectancy that would have that would be completely independent of a contract. I'm just having trouble coming up with facts.
Well, I am too. I can't imagine that there'd be one.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how business is conducted. This for that.
And a lot of the business expectancy cases are tortious interference with the formation of a contract, the pre-formation of a contract. As a practical matter, those are the facts of most of those cases. So I think that may be the answer to that question.
Well, at least you're consistent.
Thank you. And let me just make the point, in response to the questions about does any tort constitute an unlawful act, and the Dunlap's position has been throughout this case that any tort does. In station number two, there was a tort. There was a conspiracy to breach a contract is a common law tort in Virginia. And that was alleged, and the court specifically held in the station number two case that conspiracy to breach a contract is not actionable. That was a tort. That was held not actionable. It was a tort that was not independent of contract. Neither is tortious interference with the contract.
Are the cases cited in station number two and distinguished in station number two, Commercial Business Systems, Advanced Marine, Catacorp, are they not all centered on a contract? Yet we distinguish them as being somehow different.
In each of those, and in particular Advanced Marine, which they rely on, first of all, none of them addresses the issue. None of them says tortious interference is a predicate act on the business conspiracy statute. The Advanced Marine, which is the one they rely on, because the court referenced tortious interference, there's lots of other unlawful acts. There's breach of fiduciary duty, and there's misappropriation, and there's lots of other facts. Facts in this case, and the fact that the certified question presented was whether tortious interference with the contract without some other unlawful act, and there is no other unlawful act here, is sufficient under the business conspiracy statute. I'd like to turn, if I may, to the statute of limitations issue. I don't have a whole lot of time to address that, but I will. I have three points to make about that. First, often the simplest analysis is the right one. There is a catch-all provision in the statute of limitations. provisions. There is no express statute of limitations for tortious interference. Many lower court judges, both federal and state, have addressed this issue. There's more than a dozen cases that I know of. Judges are split right down the middle on this. I think that's pretty good evidence that there really isn't a provision, because a lot of smart people have looked at this and not been able to agree on what the answer is. If the injury to property analysis is as broad as Dunlap suggests, it's not clear why you need a catch-all provision. Indeed, it's not clear why you need any other statutes of limitations at all. The legislature has provided lots of them. We've seen that everything would fall into injury to property or injury to person. And I think the catch-all provision, at a minimum, expresses the legislature's view that when in doubt, when all else fails, it wants 2 years. And I think that's the proper analysis in this case, in view of the absence of any express provision in the statute, and in view of sort of secondary evidence, we have lots of judges not being able to agree on this.
But 248 says, for every personal action for which no limitation is otherwise prescribed.
Right.
So before we would get there, wouldn't we have to say that this is not damage to property? Because there is a statute of limitations for damage to property.
There is a statute of limitations for damage to property.
But isn't that a preliminary step to get there?
You have to get there.
In the Moneta case, there's a section in there, it's the section that precedes, sort of states out the principles of the decision in the case. And it says, we have previously held that an allegation of nothing more than disappointed economic expectations does not amount to an injury to property. Rather, the law of contracts provides the sole remedy for such a loss. That seems to be what you're arguing.
Exactly.
We also said immediately thereafter, we stated in, I pronounce it Pigot, whatever, P-I-G-O-T-T, that if the property is in the same condition and available for the same use after the defendant's actions as before, the alleged wrongs were directed at the plaintiffs personally rather than at their property. The problem is, in this case, the allegations are that they aren't the same before and after. And so it would seem to me that to the previous statement about economic expectations being an injury being the sole remedy in contract depends on whether the property that's at issue is in the same condition before or after.
But if you look at the complaint alleges that there was a notice of termination sent, but it also tells you that the termination was never effected. So that Mr. Dunlap had his franchise until his contract expired. We know that from the subsequent litigation between Dunlap and AMCO, in which there's a published decision. He got to keep his franchise. The franchise wasn't destroyed. And I think the import of the language you just quoted from the Mineta case is that not every breach of contract is a property right. I think that's exactly what those two sentences say. You can't just take every breach of contract and say that's an injury to property. That in some cases, and the court goes on to talk about Pigott, it's not. So I think under Willard and under Pigott and under a lot of lower court decisions, you look at what the conduct was directed at. And in this case, the allegations are that it was directed at Mr. Dunlop. We're going to squash him like a bug.
We're going to squash his business like a bug. They were going to squash him.
So the complaint says we're going to squash him.
Well, but you know they weren't going to squash him personally.
No, they weren't going to squash his business like a bug either.
Well, that's, I think it's a significant difference. Squash his business like the bug is property. Squash him is personal.
May I make one final point in the second I have left? The Fourth Circuit suggested the possibility that maybe the tortious interference should have the same statute of limitations as a breach. 5 years. In fact, there are some contracts where the statute of limitations for breach is shorter than that. Sales contracts are 4 years, oral contracts are 3 years. So holding the tortious interference as 5 years would give the anomalous result that, that the tort claim would have a longer statute of limitations than the contract claim. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.